the right thing for you. PKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT's 2020 funding drive has been postponed indefinitely, but we are still accepting donations to help us sustain the station's operations while we remain closed due to COVID-19. Our wide network of volunteers provides an essential service to many different communities in Montreal, and the isolation of the past few months has highlighted how important independent news, arts and culture, and music programming is for Montreal's underrepresented communities. If you are in a position to give during this time, visit ckut.ca and click on the green Donate button to make a contribution, or contact funding@ckut.ca if you have any questions. Thank you for your continued support. Love, CKUT.
And welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. So our first song to start off the show is going to be Jesus Etc., a song originally written by Jeff Tweedy from the band Wilco and was first recorded by Wilco. But this is a version by Angela Galupo, who is a local Montreal jazz singer whose self-titled debut album was nominated for a Jazz Juno, and here is her version of Jesus Etc.
Jesus, don't cry. You can rely on me, honey. You can combine anything you want. I'll be around. You write about the stars. Each one is a setting sun. Tall building shape, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs. Attuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Don't cry. Stars, each one is a setting sun. Tall building shape, voices escape, singing sad, sad songs. Attuned to chords strung down your cheeks, bitter melodies turning your orbit around. Skyscraper. turning your orbit around.
And that was Jesus Etc., performed by Angela Galluppo from her self-titled debut album. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to play something from sustainableworldradio.com, which is a great little website or series of podcasts that are available on a website, which is sustainableworldradio.com. And this one is with the author and gardener and farmer, Acadia Tucker. And Acadia Tucker is the author of Growing Good Food, A Citizen's Guide to Climate Victory Gardening, and Growing Perennial Foods, A Field Guide to Raising Resilient Herbs, Fruits, and Vegetables. So here, Acadia is talking about the subject of, I believe, her upcoming book, which won't be available till February of next year, but it's Tiny Victory Gardens. And she's really focusing in this interview all about container gardening. So I thought our listeners might be interested in hearing about how to do container gardening really successfully. And, you know, during the winter time, we tend to start to dream about what we're going to grow next year, those of us who garden. And I experimented a bit with container gardening this year and had some nice surprises. I finally grew some red peppers well, which I've never been able to do in my regular garden. So, container gardening. So here is Jill Cloutier interviewing Acadia Tucker about growing good food without a yard.
My guest today is an amazing farmer and plant person, Acadia Tucker. Acadia Tucker is a regenerative farmer, climate activist, and author. Acadia's books are a call to action to citizen gardeners everywhere and lay the groundwork for planting an organic, regenerative garden. Before becoming an author, Acadia started a four-season organic market garden in Washington State, where she grew 200 different food crops. Acadia now lives in Maine and New Hampshire with her farm dog, Nimbus. And when she isn't growing hops to support locally sourced craft beer, she's raising perennials in her own backyard. Acadia is the author of Growing Perennial Foods, A Field Guide to Raising Resilient Herbs, Fruits, and Vegetables, and Growing Good Food, A Citizen's Guide to Backyard Carbon Farming. And her new forthcoming book, I'm really excited about this one, and what we'll be talking about today is Tiny Victory Gardens, Growing Good Food Without a Yard. And you can find Acadia online at acadiatucker.com. Welcome to the show, Acadia.
Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you here. You are a dynamo and you are like a evangelist for the earth. It's great. And for gardens and plants everywhere. I love it.
I hope that my passion is a bit infectious and kind of can motivate other people to get involved as well.
I think it will. And, you know, you have had, like me, I think, a lifelong love affair with plants. And can you tell us just when did this start?
I mean, at the earliest ages, I kind of grew up in Maine, where we had this lake cabin, and I just grew up just kind of roaming the woods, and I just recall some of my earliest memories just being, like, truly fascinated with the trees and the forest, and I just had this, like, urge, like, oh, I really want to understand everything going around, like, what's happening, how are these growing, what's going on, and that kind of just led me to take to pursue ecology and studying plants in college. And then that later turned into this big passion for farming.
Mm, and that passion is really reverberated around the world with all of your books and teaching. So I'm excited we get to spend this time with you today. And we're going to be talking about how to grow our own food, even if you don't have a lot of land or a yard. But to begin, I would like to hear from you why you think it's important for us to grow our own food at home.
I mean, I think as a, you know, nation and just as, you know, global citizens, we've become very disconnected from our food. You know, you go shopping in the supermarket and you walk along these aisles filled with all of this beautiful produce, but a lot of people don't really have any clue where it comes from, how it's grown, who's growing it, and in turn, kind of the ramifications, the negative impacts that the way we grow food has. So I feel that if more people are connected with how they grow food, or at least who's growing their food, that we can start to kind of fix some of these negative impacts. You know, it goes to, you know, workers' rights and treatment. It goes from environmental degradation, you know, climate change kind of. The food system impacts almost every facet of our life. And I feel that people just aren't aware of that because they haven't been exposed to what it means to grow food.
Mm-hmm. And so really in this time of immense change of COVID-19 chaos and climate instability, and finally the beginnings of racial justice with Black Lives Matter, at least here in the States, how relevant, it sounds like you feel, and you just touched on this, how relevant is gardening right now?
I think it's so relevant, and it kind of harkens back to, you know, the World War II days when everybody was kind of mobilized to do something as a community back in the war days to fight a common enemy. But in today's world, I think that as a community, we need to kind of mobilize in that same aspect. And you know, a lot of urban areas are food poor. You know, a lot of people rely on fast food. So getting people to grow their own food, particularly in urban environments, can kind of give them that access to really healthy, good food that they've never had before. And I think that's really important, especially in today's world. And then leaning back on COVID, I think it kind of exposed how fragile our food system is, because everything's so globalized now. You know, we're not getting shipments of food. You know, you went to the supermarket and there are empty shelves. Before this happened, I felt like people just weren't aware that, you know, you take one piece out of the pile and it kind of all comes falling down. So, you know, teaching people and motivating people to grow their own food can just kind of help with that food security aspect and make people a little bit more self-sufficient and self-aware.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you really, a lot of your writing, you say that gardening is our civic duty.
I do honestly believe that, you know, I feel like, you know, one person by themselves, and, you know, we hear this a lot, isn't going to change the world. But how I view gardening is, you know, if all of us collectively do a little bit more to grow our own food, you know, and to build a movement, we can actually do a lot of good.
And, you know, I've had so many emails and messages from listeners who really want to be involved with this, but they don't have a yard, they live in an apartment, they only have a small deck. So today we're going to be talking a lot about container gardens. And this is a great way for people to participate in this without a lot of space.
Absolutely. And it can be a really easy way for people to get into gardening. You know, they don't have to think about hauling in all that compost or, you know, spending hours turning over the lawn into tillable land. You know, it's kind of, you know, you can start small on a comfortable scale. And once you get the hang of it, and once you kind of get sucked into how fun it is, you can just keep adding more and more containers as much as your space will allow.
Could you share with us a few examples, or just one or two, of a successful container garden?
Sure. I mean, container gardens can be any shape and size. The simplest thing, growing a few herbs that you commonly use a lot of in the kitchen. You know, if you have a sunny windowsill and you know, you love making pasta or pesto, and, you know, just growing your own herbs is a really good step forward. You know, you're not going to the grocery store and buying those clamshell herbs that, you know, you use some of it, half of it goes brown, you end up throwing it away, you know, the herbs and the plastic, creating more waste. If you kind of grow what you need, to me, that's kind of what I call the gateway garden. It's like,
I do too. I was just going to say, it's the gateway. It's the way into gardening.
And herbs are pretty simple to grow. You know, a lot of the times, especially grown in containers, the number one killer of herbs is people just love them too much, is what I like to say. They give them too much care. Herbs are pretty rugged and they actually don't need a lot of attention from us. So that's another reason why they're kind of the easiest thing to start with. But, you know, if you do have a little bit of outside space, that allows you to explore a little bit more with you know, everybody loves tomatoes and peppers, or even there's dwarf cultivars of all of our favorite fruit, apples, pears. You can really, you know, the sky's the limit. As long as you have the right space with sun and the right size container, you'd really be surprised at how much you can grow for yourself.
That's inspiring and exciting for people. And I would love to start with the soil, because building soil health and fertility and creating the conditions for soil biology to really thrive is really important in gardening, right? And
absolutely.
So, yeah, is this possible in container gardening?
It is. I mean, for the larger containers, say, especially raised beds and you know, anything that's larger than a 3x3 space, you really can cultivate a healthy soil ecosystem. But when we get to the smaller pots, and especially anything indoors, kind of building up that community of decomposers and aerators and all of those soil organisms we've come to depend upon on in-ground agriculture don't really exist. So you kind of have to rely on building your soil from the beginning and making a really good soil mix, or purchasing a really good soil mix that will kind of do the work for you. And then we kind of have to do some of the heavy lifting by, you know, maybe using some supplementary fertilizer, stuff like that, to replace the action of decomposition and nutrient building that normally happens in the soil horizons.
Mm-hmm. That might not be the most appetizing thing if you're sitting in your living room and you have all your little decomposer friends come out when your friends
are
what can
you do with you? Hey.
You might be really excited. Oh my gosh, look at that cute.
I was gonna say, that's actually right up my alley, but I understand how not would appreciate that.
So you're saying then that if you have a small outdoor space, you can grow things, a sunny windowsill, and also indoors, which I know I didn't even think about indoors.
Yeah, I mean, indoors is more challenging than outside, and it's usually just an issue of sunlight. Just because you have a really sunny room doesn't mean that the light is intense enough to grow, especially fruiting crops like tomatoes, berries, stuff like that. A lot of plants need what's called direct sunlight. So if those leaves can't look up at the sky and see the sun, the intensity of the light isn't enough, and they'll start to stretch towards it, which just creates kind of weak and leggy plants. My house is in the woods, so it's pretty shaded, but I love to grow plants, so I rely a lot on grow lights. I just have them set up on a timer. They turn on and off automatically when I need them to. They're pretty inexpensive. They clip onto the table that my plant's on, and I kind of just set it and forget it once it's all set up. I have a banana plant in my house growing that way.
Wow. So because you've lived in different climates, and I know that you moved back to a colder climate, right, after being in a bit warmer.
Yes. I used to live in Washington, which was, I always called it the ideal temperature. It never got above 80 and it never got below 35 degrees. So it was kind of
perfect.
This really beautiful window for growing and living. And now I live in southern Maine. And as you can imagine, the winters are quite brutal here. So I have to really pick my, especially perennial plants, according to, you know, what's going to survive and be able to overwinter. And anything I like to grow that won't comes inside for the winter.
Oh my gosh. Now we'll get more into that, but I'm just wondering about how do plants that are inside, what do you do about pollination?
So that can be a bit tricky. I do like to set up small fans around my plants. And to be honest, in the wintertime, I'm not necessarily expecting like a very high yield in my tomato plants. It's more overwintering kind of the rootstock. So when I do put them back outside in the spring, they have that much more of an advantage and that much more roots that they can grow quickly and get that harvest sooner from then. In terms of, you know, like my banana plant, that won't really need pollination other than the breeze. So you kind of do have to think about those things accordingly. There's always, you know, the paper bag trick where you can put paper bag over your plant and shake it around. There's the paintbrush trick where you can actually paint pollen onto the blossoms of plants. And I always joke, if you do that just once, you really start to appreciate the natural pollinators.
Yes,
that we have.
I know.
And you start to care more about the bees and the thousands of different wasps that we rely on for pollination. And that just goes back to another connection that you start to forge once you start to experiment growing your own food. And even if you're not successful, if you walk away with one thing like a better appreciation for bees, everybody's better off for it.
Exactly. And so let's talk about some of the plants that are happy growing in container gardens. So say that you have a little bit of space or a deck outside. What are some plants that where you would be successful?
So I always tell people that the most successful are leafy greens. So that could be lettuce or the hardier greens like kale or chard. They do really well in kind of a close-knit area. I also plant a lot of radishes in containers because they grow so quickly and you can plant them so early in the spring that by the time they're ready to be harvested, I can put in another plant right after it. So I can kind of stack functions or use that small space as efficiently as possible. So I pull my radishes out, maybe I plant my cucumber in after or my tomatoes, the plants that really need the hot heat to thrive. The other, you know, you really can plant anything in a container, from raspberries, blueberries, like I mentioned, fruiting trees. As long as that container is large enough to support the roots that are going into it and it gets sufficient water and nutrients, the sky is really the limit.
That's good news, right? For a lot of people.
It is good news. But it takes, you know, I always tell people to start small, start with the herbs. Start with growing your own lettuce. Don't take off too big of a bite at first, because a lot of the times you're going to fail your first few goes. And I don't want people to get frustrated. I want them to feel empowered, right? So by taking baby steps and starting small, you can kind of build up that confidence and that courage to try maybe something a little bit more complex or a little bit more needy.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And it's really easy. I had a soybean. I have a garden in the ground. And then I also have a lot of things in pots outside due to the gophers. But my soybean plant this year, I planted seeds. I grew everything from seed this year, which I really learned patience, because my neighbor's plants that he bought are like double in size of mine. It's like, this is a long, slow process. And my soybean, which I totally fell in love with, it was the cutest seedling I've almost ever seen. And I put pictures on Instagram and I was totally boasting about it. And then I put it in the ground and within a month it was like, help me. And then I went out, and it's a skeleton now, so it's terrible. So no more pictures on on Instagram, but that's what gardening, right? Because then my cucumbers, I've been getting tons of cucumbers. So it's really interesting how the failures and the successes, and don't give up if you do have those failures.
Exactly. And just learn from them. Take notes. So like, okay, maybe why didn't that soybean do well? Did I put it outside too early? Was it too cold? Was the soil too cold? You know, why are my cucumbers doing well? Were they in a good spot? Did I give them a little bit of fertilizer? You know, kind of taking notes. And one of the beautiful things about gardening is you always have next year. You can always try again. There's never an end date. There's just a pause. So I think that's one of my favorite things about gardening is, oh, I'll try something because I think it might work. It doesn't work. Okay. I'll take notes about it and tweak it for next season. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of like a game, like, oh, how much bigger can I get this plant? Or what's the biggest tomato I can? One time I grew a 3-pound tomato and I was just so excited.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, you kind of make it like this game. And then you just get excited every time, you know, oh, it's the winter time, the seed catalogs are coming, and you just like this excitement just kind of builds and grows in you until you don't really care anymore if you fail, because you've already thought about how to make it better for the next season.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And you learn, which is great. And so are bigger pots always better?
I mean, it's not necessarily a black and white question, but I'm going to say yes. The reason I say that is because they're usually heavier, so they're not going to blow over, which can be a problem sometimes, especially if you're on a balcony, you know, 20 floors up in the city. So they're heavier, they retain moisture a lot better because of the volume of soil. They're a lot less likely to dry out. And then the more room your plants have to stretch out and grow, the bigger they're going to be. If you've ever heard of, you know, a root-bound plant, right? So its roots just spiral and spiral around the pot and it has nowhere to go. And it can actually eventually just start to choke itself so that it can't get the nutrients and water to where it needs to be. So the big, you know, if you have a big pot, you're pretty much going to avoid that altogether. But I, you know, obviously space is an issue. So I always recommend, you know, find the biggest container that's going to work for you and then, you know, plant accordingly.
And what do you like better, clay, plastic, wine barrels? I've been planting in those to avoid plastic.
Yeah, although you have to remember to drill holes in the bottom.
Yes, we put holes in, yes.
Because I did once, and it was a soupy mess, and it didn't turn out well. I would say my favorite, you know, I'm kind of old school, and I really do love the look and feel of terracotta pots. They also have another benefit is that they're porous. So while that means the soil does lose moisture more quickly when planted in terracotta, it also allows air to get into the soil, and it kind of allows the soil to breathe a little bit more than plastic pots or glazed ceramic pots. Wood pots are similar, where it allows kind of the soft expansion and airflow within the soil. So I always lean towards those, but knowing that the downside of these kind of porous pots are that you do have to water them a bit more frequently.
Mm-hmm. That's been the hardest thing for me with containers, is because I have a lot of terracotta, and then I have some plastic that was given to me, and then the wine barrels, it does dry out, and the temperature gauging is kind of tough.
It is tough. It's very tough. And one of the harder things about container growing is dealing with the heat. If you have these pots, you know, on a baking balcony or out where all day sun, it can be very difficult to keep up and have, you know, the right water management. And that can be frustrating for people. So I always urge people, you know, if you're confident enough or you want to invest in a small irrigation system, or I have this kind of, you know, we call it main technique, where we just find a big Coke bottle or something and you can fill that up with water and kind of just shove it upside down in the soil, and it will slowly release throughout the day.
That's great.
It's kind of like a quick hack to you know, a self-watering system. But they do also, you can purchase self-watering pots, which I've been experimenting for research for this book I'm writing. You know, how efficient are they? Do I like them? Do they work? And all it is usually a plastic or resin container with a reservoir below where the plant sits in the soil, with a wick coming up through the soil profile. And as long as you keep that reservoir full, water travels up the wick and keeps the soil moist. So it's been interesting experimenting with those, because you never have to, you know, maybe you fill that reservoir once a week, maybe you fill it every 2 weeks. It can be very convenient. But the one drawback I have found from them is that surface mold on the soil, because it's never fully drying out, can be a problem. And then, you know, where I live, it's very, very humid. So anytime you get surface mold, it can jump onto the leaves and it can kind of create a little bit of a mess that way. But I would recommend it for very arid, dry places for sure.
Yes. And, you know, plants too, once you've been around them enough, and for me, you can kind of just tell watering when they need to be watered, when they get that awful look.
Yeah,
it's like, how could you do this to me?
Help me.
So the more you do it, the more that you read them, kind of read what they're saying, I think.
Yeah. And like I said, I found, you know, the biggest complaint, you know, I get is people come up to me and go, what's wrong? And they show me a picture, and, you know, 8 times out of 10, they've just overwatered their plants.
Hmm.
Which is, you know, because they just, you know, I wouldn't say they obsess, but they, you know, they want to succeed, so they try a little bit too hard.
It's true. And I think it's good for plants often to have it dry a bit and then get water again.
Yeah, there's very few plants that like consistent, what I always call wet feet. You know, the soil is always damp and moist. A lot of plants like a really deep and thorough watering, but then they like to have a little bit of time where that soil dries out, because roots need air just like we do to breathe. So if the soil is constantly filled, all those little pores and channels in the soil, if that's constantly filled with water, there's no air. So the roots actually suffocate.
Good to know. I think I've been guilty of that in the past. And the opposite. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Plant disaster stories.
What I always kind of recommend to people is, you know, stick your finger in the pot. If it's dry up to your second knuckle, then you can water. But if it's still wet, just wait a few more days.
That's good. I like that. Say that you have your pots, you have your herbs growing on your windowsill, and then you have your pots in your little area. I think it was in a blog post that I read of yours, or maybe on your website, you do have a recipe for potting medium, which was really great.
I do, and I kind of go back and forth a little bit, but I always try to use compost, a little bit of sand. And what I've been experimenting with is what's called coconut core. And the reason I have gone towards that direction is because traditional potting mixes are usually made with peat. And it can be actually quite devastating, the mining process of peat, because in natural ecosystem, these peat bogs only form a little bit of peat over a decade. So we're pretty much over harvesting these ecosystems and pretty much destroying them. That and it has to get bagged and shipped. So moving away from peat is another way, as gardeners, we can be a little bit more sustainable. So I've been trying these different mediums to see what's a good replacement of peat, because peat really is this great soilless medium. It holds on to water, it supports root growth. So coconut coir, and that C-O-I-R, is one of the newer substitutes that people are using, and it's a byproduct of the coconut industry. So it's kind of these long fibrous mediums that absorbs water like peat, kind of does all of those same functions, but isn't destroying an ecosystem.
And peat is also a good sink for carbon, which we'll talk about in a bit.
Absolutely.
I think, right? So that's another benefit that it has when it's intact. And so you filled up your pots, you planted your plants, and then I'm curious, could you do some layering in your garden to where you kind of like food forest layering, but you have things in containers?
Absolutely. You can kind of, growing food can be quite beautiful, and you can, much like you'd plant a flower pot on your deck with, something tall in the middle, some medium layers around it, stuff overflowing from the sides. You can do the same with food crops. You can put your big tomato in the center. You can put lettuce or carrots around the base. You can have peas kind of draping off your pot. You can really get creative as long as you don't overplant your pot. You can do a lot of cool things.
Sounds great. I'm sure it can be really beautiful. What are some fertilizers and amendments that you like to use to help plants grow?
I always, when I'm making my potting mix, sometimes I'll mix in some granular amendments like bone meal, or, mycelium powder, something dry that you can mix into the soil. But as plants are starting to grow, I tend to rely more on liquid fertilizers. And the reason I do that is because they're much faster acting. They're readily available, so the plant roots can absorb them right away. You can even spray them on the leaves of plants because they have the ability to absorb nutrients through their leaves, which is also really cool. And I just like a very kind of low-grade fish fertilizer is definitely one of my go-tos. It has, a decent amount of nitrogen, but then also enough phosphorus and potassium to support blooms and healthy fruit development. But I do want to warn those who are trying to grow some vegetables inside is that if you do use a liquid organic fertilizer, they tend to be kind of stinky. Mm-hmm. And I recently fertilized my houseplants with, you know, my favorite fish fertilizer. And unbeknownst to my boyfriend, I found him when I came home standing on a chair, knocking on the walls and smelling and saying, oh my gosh, something's died in here.
Oh, and like honey.
Yeah, it turned out just to be my plants. But a quick way you can get rid of the smell is just any essential oil you have. You can just mix it with a little bit of water, spritz it over your plants, and the problem solved.
I fertilized my flip-flop and my foot once with fish emulsion because I was pouring it over a plant. It splashed up. That shoe is never the same.
It can be, and that's the one, you know, I always recommend people rely on organics. But that is, you know, one of the drawbacks is it can kind of have a pretty potent smell. Mm-hmm.
It's not terrible. It's just pungent.
Yeah.
And so we know that compost, you mentioned compost, but compost and mulch are really important, right? And keeping our plants in the ground nice and moist and protecting the microbial life. And is it possible to use, to do composting? We talked about amendments, but is mulch, can you mulch your plants and your container plants as well?
Yes. And in fact, I do recommend it. Mm-hmm. The number one, you know, you might not have that soil community that can feed off, you know, you're not going to reap all the benefits of mulch, but the benefits you do have is the biggest one is moisture retention. So that mulch is going to, one, keep water from evaporating out of your soil, and two, it's actually going to help keep your soil temperature cooler. One of the problems with container gardening is that, you know, that soil is exposed on all the sides of that container. And when the sides of that container get hot, so does the soil inside the pot. And sometimes even if the plant is watered enough, the soil temperature can be too hot and cause the roots to die off. So using a bit of mulch on the surface can help prevent that.
What mulch do you like to use in containers?
I've experimented with a lot of mulches. I mean, I always use what I have available. I don't go out of my way and spend money on mulch. So a lot of times I rely on shredded leaves or some straw, some leftover straw from the chicken coop or wood shavings from the chicken coop. But you can get really creative and you can even have, you know, pretty decorative stones. If you live in an area where there's a lot of nut production, the hulls of nuts are really good. You can use even towels or blankets. You can really use anything as long as you're still able to water through it.
Good to know. This is great. And then you talked about how almost any plant can grow in a container. Are there some that just don't want to be bound like that in a container?
I think some of the harder plants, I mean, pretty much any annual you'll be fine with because they're really just staying in there for one growing season. Some of the problems you can run into is with the perennials that you plant in pots, because as they grow and die back each winter, their roots get bigger, their branches get bigger, and they can really just start to outgrow your pot. And that's when you can run into problems if you don't recognize that maybe you need to transplant it into a bigger location. Or if you don't have a bigger location, you can take it out of its pot and divide it and then plant the smaller pieces and maybe give away the excess to a friend or a neighbor so that they can start their own little container garden.
Yeah, that was one of my questions, because you're really an advocate. I think you wrote a book, right, about perennials.
Yeah,
and growing perennials. Yeah, so this is kind of the other end of the spectrum is the containers.
It is, and you know, and I still say you can grow almost any perennial in a container as long as you recognize that it will eventually outgrow that home. And you'll, like I said, either need to find it a bigger home or divide it so that it is a smaller plant again.
Gotcha. And then are there any other challenges that people should know about in container gardening, or have we covered them?
I think the two biggest are definitely, you know, watering and fertilizing. because the plant roots can't explore the ground and find those things on their own. It's relying on us to provide them. But I think the other common problem would be disease, and that would be kind of your root rots from overwatering, or if you packed your container with too many plants, you can have that lack of circulation can breed, you know, surface molds like powdery mildew. But in terms of the other garden chores, let's say weeding, it's essentially you don't have to weed at all, which is just a really beautiful thing. And then in terms of pest control, because you have these little islands of plants, it's harder for a pest outbreak to occur. And when it does, it's such a small area that usually just picking off the bugs or squishing the bugs with your fingers is enough to fix the problem.
Mm-hmm. And gophers, too. It helps with gophers.
It helps with gophers, and it helps with deer. I have a lot of deer pressure in my in-ground garden. I had to build a big fence around it. The one thing that still pesters some of my pots, though, are squirrels.
Mm.
And they just seem to be jerks about it. They don't actually want to eat it. They just like take a big bite out of it and then leave it there.
Oh, I know. The animals, they definitely, they're like, thank you for gardening for me.
Yeah. And I do think that bigger pests, not necessarily the bugs, can be one of the more disheartening aspects of gardening that really kind of bum people out and maybe make them reconsider doing it in the future. But, you know, you can be creative, and maybe you want to plant your friends their own container further away from the containers you care about. That might draw them towards that. Or I've used Tavahart traps a lot in the past, which is just a cruelty-free way to capture them. And you just put them in the back of the car, drive them a few miles, 10 miles down the road, and, you know, find a nice wooded area and let them go.
Yeah, you don't want to release them close to a neighbor's.
No, unless you don't like them very much.
Yeah. Oh,
but don't let
God.
Them see you doing it.
In the dark of night, in dark
clinic.
Oh my gosh. So is there anything else about container gardening that you'd like to share with us today?
I think we've covered a lot of ground, which is awesome. I think I would just go back to saying, you know, even if you don't think you can do it, or even if you've tried and failed in the past, amid everything that's going on now, this is a great time to start again and to try to grow your own food and become part of this movement where we can all kind of get back to the roots, to speak about how our food is grown and what good food really means.
We're getting a bit close to the end of the interview, but I had a couple more questions. And you had the market garden in Washington where you grew 200 plants, 200 different types of plants. And I'm curious, what are a few of your favorite plants right now to grow in your, and I know you have a garden right now too as well, right? Besides the indoor.
I do have a garden, yep. My favorite, that's a really hard, that's like trying to choose between your children. I really enjoy my berry bushes at the moment because, you know, raspberries, blueberries, blackberries, strawberries, because once you've had a kind of a homegrown fruit, it's really hard to buy them from the grocery store. And I feel that I kind of shy away from them. So this time of the year, it's kind of a gluttony thing. Like you have so much variety, so much to indulge in, that they quickly become my favorite plants in the garden. But early season, I think my favorite plants would be my broccoli plants. And I like to grow this type of broccoli called Gailan. It's a sprouting Chinese broccoli, I believe. Mm. And you can even eat the thicker stalks because there's no hair or fuzz. And I like to make a lot of stir fries with just whatever I have in my fridge. And that's always kind of a champion whenever I cook it.
Ooh, and what was the name of it again?
Gailan.
How do you spell that?
G-A-I-L-A-N. It's great. And as soon as you cut off some of the florets, it produces new ones. The only thing that really exhausts it is when it gets really hot in the summertime and it just doesn't like to grow anymore. I also like sorrel, if you've ever had
Ooh,
sorrel.
Yes.
just because it's, you don't expect a green, like it looks like a little spinach leaf, to have, it's sour, to have this lemony, flavorful, bright taste that you only need a little bit of it when you cook. You can cook it, eat it raw, but it's always just like this most surprising flavor coming from a green leaf.
Oh, yum. I've had sorrel soup. It's so good. So let's switch gears. I wanted to talk to you a bit about climate change. And you started farming at age 21. And on your website, it says you didn't give much thought to climate change. Can you tell us how your experience in farming led you back to school to study soil management and then kind of embark on this other path of being a climate activist?
Yeah. So when I first started farming, it was right after college. Two of my best friends and I had this amazing opportunity to kind of start this market farm from donated land that used to be this old nursery. So we kind of gung-ho left school, went right up to the farm and started to grow food. And it didn't take us very long to realize that the weather patterns and the climate were changing. And in the summertime, we had 15 hours of sunlight because we were at the northern tip of Washington State. And it would just, the sun would just beat down on the farm and the soil was dry and hard and cracked. And then it would just rain for like 3 or 4 days torrentially. And the ground was so parched that the water wasn't really even sinking in. It was just running off and going straight into the rivers and ocean. And we, this pattern just kind of kept happening. And we started to talk to the community members and then the threat of forest fires was happening. And it just became very clear that, what was normal was now changing. And we started to kind of get this anxiety of like, okay, well, we need to figure this out. And we knew that every other farmer in the world was also facing this kind of same struggle. So it motivated me to go back to school to get my master's in what's called soil and water management, to try to learn how can we treat the soil to better, handle these extremes.
Mm-hmm. And so, can you tell us then, so you went to school, got your degree, and then how can gardening and farming be an act of climate activism?
So the soil has this natural ability to absorb carbon out of the atmosphere. So that greenhouse gas that everybody talks about, carbon dioxide, can actually be stored in the soil through plant photosynthesis. But the problem comes with the way we treat our soil and the way we farm industrially releases that carbon stored in the soil back into the atmosphere. So rather than holding it there and keeping it out of the air, we are actively adding more into the climate and kind of, feeding this negative loop. On average, 50 to 70% of the world's agricultural soils have lost, a lot of their carbon. And not only is that bad for the climate, but it's bad for soil fertility. It makes growing food harder. So the remarkable ability for gardening and farming in a way that stores that carbon underground is really exciting. And that's kind of, when I talk about, a community of gardeners working together to do something powerful, that's kind of what I mean is, we all have this ability to do just a little bit more to help fight climate change, just as recycling or shopping locally, kind of all of these little things that an individual can do. When enough of us do all of these little things, it can be quite powerful.
Mm-hmm. And that really, I think you write about having a carbon sucking mini farm, like how our gardens can be. I really truly believe it could be all hands on deck if we all use land and garden and plant management that helped suck that excess carbon out of the atmosphere and keep it in the ground. It would make a huge difference worldwide.
It would. And there's about, I think, I can't remember the exact acreage off the top of my head, but lawns and turf in America take up 3 times more land than all of the corn grown in the U.S.
Wow.
So there's a lot of available space for us to be utilizing in this manner.
And so what are some ways that people can manage their garden or land that would help keep that carbon in the ground and even suck more out of the atmosphere?
The biggest thing that we can all do is to stop tilling. So every time you break into the soil and flip it over, you're releasing all of that stored carbon into the atmosphere. So adopting no-till practices, which can be very difficult on an industrial farm scale, but it turns out it's actually quite easy on a, you know, a small farm or garden scale. There's this technique I like to use to build up my soil called sheet mulching. So you start with a layer of moistened cardboard, and then you just start stacking all these layers of brown and green things like leaves, grass clippings, kelp, kitchen scraps. You kind of cover it with leaves or hay, and then you can actually plant directly into that. And then over time, the soil organisms from, you know, the original soil you built on top of work their way into that kind of compost heap and start to break it down. And with that process, that carbon that they're eating and decomposing becomes part of their bodies. And then when those soil organisms die, that carbon is locked underground, as long as we don't kick it back up again by tilling. So, you know, the gardener's goal, in my opinion, should be kind of acknowledging what's called the carbon cycle, which is what I'm talking about, the flow of carbon through an ecosystem, and knowing how to pause it in the right place. So that soil carbon isn't moving into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And I think planting perennials and trees can really help as well.
Absolutely. When you plant perennials and trees, you know, you only have to dig up the soil once to do it. And once they're there, they have these beautiful, long, extensive root systems that are just the perfect place for soil organisms to overwinter. So the more soil organisms, the more decomposition, the more, you know, biomass of carbon stored underground.
And can those without a yard participate in a climate victory garden or in carbon capture?
On a very, very small scale, and like I said, it really is only possible in the larger containers like raised beds, where you're not going to be dumping that soil out. But the benefit of container gardening in terms of climate is, you know, maybe you'll take less trips to the supermarket. Maybe you'll start to eat more seasonally. Maybe you'll appreciate growing food a little bit more. So you'll start to buy from your local farmer or get to know your local farmer or have your neighbors and family over for a dinner party with food you grew, which then convinces them to grow their own food. So you can kind of start to have a similar chain reaction where you might not be helping to draw carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but you're helping to reduce your personal carbon footprint and those around you.
And you're not tilling up land as well.
And you're not tilling up land. So it's you know, it's these all these side benefits that you can still tap into with container growing.
And community gardens are another great alternative if you don't have land. A lot of neighborhoods around the world, they have these community gardens where you can sign up and get a plot of land there.
Yes, and those community gardens are excellent climate victory gardens because, you know, usually they have the support of people who kind of know what they're doing. So if you're starting from scratch and you need some guidance, joining a community garden is a great way to go because there's somebody there who has all the answers and can kind of help you and walk you through the process until you're an expert yourself and then can then go on to teach somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of wisdom found in community gardens. This has been a very, very challenging time for many of us. And COVID has shown us, though, one bright part of this is that it has shown us that we can lower carbon emissions. And so I love your idea of climate victory gardens. Really piggybacking on that idea that we do have power and we could do this if we put our mind to it and united and joined together.
Absolutely. I mean, that's you know, my main goal is to let people know that there is this sense of empowerment. You know, you might seem overwhelmed. You might seem like you just want to stick your head in the sand because the problem is so big and it's so vast and it requires the cooperation of, you know, many world leaders, and it's hard to get everybody to cooperate and get along. But if you just start to do these small individual things that you do have control over, you start to feel a little bit more empowered, and then a community around that builds up. And then maybe as a group, you can go on to, you know, lobby your policymakers or kind of do these larger actions that by yourself seem quite overwhelming.
You talk a lot about victory gardens, and I think that this plays on the coming together of what people accomplished in World War II, right?
Yeah.
This whole idea. Yeah, so you're just adding in the climate victory gardens.
Exactly. You know, I feel like it's such a good example of the World War II climate victory gardens. At their height, they were growing 40% of the nation's food. Like, that's a really remarkable feat. And I just feel like if we could do it then, why can't we do it now?
Yes, let's do it.
Exactly.
In a container, in a whatever you have, in a small patch.
Soil, whatever you can do, you could just start and it will just kind of snowball from there.
Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners today, Acadia?
I think I would just let everyone know, like I said, you know, I know gardening can be frustrating, especially for those who feel like they have that black thumb that people say they have. But I just, you know, I'm a very hopeful, almost annoyingly hopeful person. So I always just say, don't give up. Just keep trying. It can't hurt.
And we can find you online at acadiatucker.com. And your new book is Tiny Victory Gardens, Growing Good Food Without a Yard. And so we can look for your book to come out when?
It should be, if everything goes well. It should be out by Christmas.
That's great. Thank you so much.
And that was an interview with Acadia Tucker, the author of a number of different books, including Growing Good Food and Growing Perennial Foods, and her upcoming book, which is not out until February of next year, which is Tiny Victory Gardens. And that was from sustainableworldradio.com, a podcast produced and hosted by Jill Cloutier. That's all the time we have left in the show. Thanks for listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. You can always follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EcolibriumCKUTMontreal. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young, and you can follow me on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. Thanks for listening. We're going to leave you with some music from the late Stan Rogers, the amazing maritime folk singer, and this is the tune Man with Blue Dolphin. Have a great day.
Now it was just like him, he had to pick a boat gone from dowdy to derelict in half a dozen years, a searching for an owner. She maybe left her heart in the harbor mud, but she really caught his at the flood, and he wonders how he knew that she was waiting for a loner. Blue dolphin built by the ruling men, she's lying on the bottom again with only him to care. The blue nose had a sister, he lost the house and he sold the car. His wife walked out, so he hit the bars and hit up every friend to raise the blue dolphin. And even afloat, she's the hole in the water where his money goes. Every dollar goes, and it's driving him crazy. He pounds his fist wide on the dock in the night and cries, I'm gonna win, and licks the blood away, and he's gonna raise the dolphin. Dolphin's lying like a wounded whale. She's hungry for a scrap of a sail to get her underway. Back to salt water. Now there's a man lying spent in the winter sun. He wonders what the hell he has done and who would ever pay to
save his schooner daughter. Or even a boat, she's the hole in the water where his money goes. Every dollar goes, and it's driving him crazy. 8 pounds his fist white on the dock in the night and cries, I'm gonna win. And licks the blood away, and he's berates the daughter. And even a bloke, she's the hole in the water where his money goes. Every dollar goes, and it's driving him crazy.
Spread of the virus. Wear a mask in public places, such as on public transit and in grocery stores and businesses. The best way to protect your health and the health of those around you is still to follow recognized hygiene measures. For example, washing your hands regularly and keeping your distance. Let's continue to...
Hey everybody, Derek Sega here. So we won't be hosting our families for the holidays this year, but let's look on the bright side. Got an aunt with some zany theories? Just mute her on the family video calls. A hippie cousin that bring new wave sludge to Réveillon? Not this year. To protect your family's health and safety, it's important you stay home and enjoy the peace and quiet.
Put your pants on, time to shovel the driveway!
Right away, hon. Safe holidays. Let's keep our spirits up.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
In the fight against COVID-19, we must all continue to respect public health guidelines and follow self-isolation instructions. Self-isolate if you have symptoms. Self-isolate after testing. Self-isolate if the test is positive. Self-isolate when you return from a trip. And self-isolate when you've been in contact with someone who's tested positive. Self-isolation is important. Please, take it seriously. Learn more at quebec.ca/self-isolating. A message from the gouvernement.